This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. After the death of George Floyd, the city council members of Minneapolis pledged to dismantle the city's police force and implement an entirely new way of handling public safety. Major cities like New York and Los Angeles have since promised major cuts and divestments from police budgets. And yesterday, Indianapolis's own city-county council unanimously declared racism as a public health crisis in Indianapolis and Marion County. As cities begin to signal movement towards addressing the demands of protesters, we'll talk today with local leaders of Black Lives Matter to find out what specific changes to police actions and accountability they want to see realized. If you have questions or comments for us, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation today and in front of our panel. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me live now is an organizer of the Black Lives Matter group in Gary, Indiana, Kim McGee. Kim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi.
Also with us is Jordan Geiger, an organizer within the Black Lives Matter group in South Bend, Indiana. Jordan, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Jordan, I'll start with you. South Bend has been protesting for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, but also for South Bend's own Eric Logan. Can you talk about the recent history of police violence in South Bend?
Yeah, it's been a longstanding issue. But last year on Father's Day, June 16th, Eric Logan was murdered by a white police officer named Ryan O'Neill. And that sparked a lot of outrage in the community. And we started organizing protests and demonstrations due to Mayor Pete, due to him running for the presidency. It brought a lot of national attention here locally. And so we started making demands around police reform. So we have demanded a citizens review board, and currently there is a police complaint board bill that is being looked at by the city council. We've also demanded that officers take the intercultural development inventory, which is essentially, in layman's terms, a cultural competency test. And also we've called for the funding of the police. We don't feel that any new dollars really should go towards policing, and we don't feel that they should hire more police officers because they're saying that they're understaffed right now. And what we've argued is that instead of hiring more police officers who don't come from our communities and who have been terrorizing our communities, we feel that they should hire violence interventionists, people who live in the community, who have relationships with folks in the community, and who can help to de-escalate situations without the police having to get involved.
Would you say that the national attention South Bend got after the death of Eric Logan was helpful to your cause, or did it muddy the waters in a way?
No, it was absolutely helpful because it shed a light on the issue that most folks here were not aware of. They didn't know how bad the policing situation was, how strained the relationship is between the police and the Black community. And so once the national, you know, media started coming in and they were really looking into Mayor Pete's record, folks were just taken aback by what all came out.
Was Ryan O'Neill, the officer who shot Eric Logan, held accountable?
No, he has not been held accountable. He quit his job, I think, because he knew that there was prior to the Eric, I think a couple of days prior to the Eric Logan situation, they have found that he was with a sex worker while on the clock. And so before that came out, he quit the force. So I think he might be working like in another, you know, force locally or nearby in a nearby city. But he has not been held accountable. They did not bring up charges against him. The special prosecutor actually said that he was in the right for what he was doing. The community didn't get any concrete answers as to, like, why this evidence was there. I mean, they said that he was burglarizing cars. They said he had a stereo and a purse. Okay, where's the purse? Where's the stereo? You know, he wasn't known to be a car thief. So that just didn't make sense to folks. They said he had a knife. And, you know, most people in the community are like, you know, Black people, we don't or at least in our Black community, we don't carry around knives. Like, if anything, we're carrying around pistols to protect ourselves, not a knife. So he has not been held accountable or anything.
And it's our understanding he was wearing a body cam. However, it was not turned on at the time, which could have helped with evidence after the fact. Did South Bend police make any changes in practice or policy afterwards regarding that?
The chief and the mayor, who was Pete at the time, they issued essentially an executive order mandating that all officers have to turn on their body cameras when they come in contact with citizens. But there have been cases that we found where they have turned the cameras off. So it's mandatory that they turn them on, but officers still have discretion. It's not set in stone what the consequences are if you do not turn on your body camera, because there is no discipline matrix in place for the South Bend Police Department presently.
Coming back to the protests we've seen in the last 2 weeks, what are the list of demands today that protesters want to see happen in South Bend?
Yep. So, like I said, we are demanding that the city council pass a police complaint board with some amendments to the current bill that's before them right now. We've asked that officers be administered the IDI, or the Intercultural Development Inventory. We've called for no new raises in officer pay because we have not gotten justice for Eric Logan, so they should not be rewarded with any pay. And also, lastly, reparations for Eric Logan's family. His mother should receive some kind of payment from the city for the loss that she suffered.
We're talking about ideas around police reform, and in this first segment, we're joined by two representatives from Black Lives Matter, one from Gary, Kim McGee, and Jordan Geigers, who we've been talking with, who represents the Black Lives Matter group in South Bend, Indiana. Kim, we'll go to you now. What is the relationship like between police and the community in Gary?
Well, I think it really depends on what part of the community you may be part of. I think that a lot of older individuals in the community, and they also tend to be more politically active and vocal, that their relationship is stronger. And with the younger community, it's more of a mixed bag. So,
have there been instances of police violence in the past, and have those officers who have committed that violence or the departments been held accountable?
There have definitely been instances, and no, none of the officers have been held accountable. Just in the past year, towards the end of 2019, two different individuals, well-known cases, Rasheed Cunningham and Melvin Bowler, were both killed by Gary police. And Rashad Cunningham was 25. Melvin Bowler was actually an 82-year-old man who was coming out of his family member's house. The police had been called due to some kind of an altercation with someone else in the family, and he was getting in his car, and basically he was hard of hearing. They knew coming to the call that, you know, he was an older gentleman, and they shot up the car, and he actually hung on for a couple months after that, but he did pass away in the hospital. There were, at least 10 bullet holes just in the windshield of the car. And basically, I would say in either one of those cases, that case or Rashad Cunningham, the prosecutor in Lake County, they haven't even released their decision on the cases. And so basically that's how cases go here, where Gary, there's a shooting with the police, a killing, and Lake County is supposed to investigate, and then the prosecutor takes that and decides whether or not to prosecute. And it takes often a very long time for them to even release their findings. So it's basically, you know, just a waiting game, and it's all just kind of swept under the rug. So in a couple of years ago, that was when Thomas Watkins, he was killed by Gary police. And it was several months, probably not until the beginning of the next year, until they released their decision that it was so-called justified, which is always the decision they release. It's just about how long it even takes them to release it. Mm. Before that, Kamonte Cobbs, he was 15 years old in 2017. He was killed by police. His mother is still in court. It actually took months for her to even receive more information. She had to go to court to even receive the evidence and information from the police regarding the case. So there are really several cases in Gary just in the last few years of, you know, families that we know personally that have had issues where there were their loved one was killed by Gary police and didn't receive justice and sometimes didn't even receive, you know, answers, really. So really part of what we've mostly been asking for the last few years, we've been advocating for an independent civilian review board.
And so can you talk about
where civilians would be involved in the process, really everything from the investigation, you know, until the end stages.
And these, yeah. How would that work? We only have about a minute left, but how would a civilian review board work?
Well, basically, you know, a board of, you know, of actual civilians as opposed to, you know, police and officials that would be involved in the process of, you know, investigating and determining the facts in each case.
We have been talking to Kim McGee, an organizer within the chapter of Black Lives Matter in Gary, and we've also been talking with Jordan Geiger, an organizer within the South Bend chapter, and they will be back with us after the break. And we will be welcoming into the conversation IUPD's first chief diversity officer, as well as an expert in criminal justice and comparative policing. As always, we want your questions and comments on social media. What changes do you imagine for police departments of the future? And what does it take to build a safe society? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about police reform in Indiana communities. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're joined live now by four guests. We still have Jordan Geiger via Skype. He's an organizer for the Black Lives Matter chapter in South Bend, Indiana. Kim McGee is with us from Northwest Indiana. She's an organizer with the Black Lives Matter chapter in Gary. And joining us now via Skype is David Kim, a lecturer on criminal justice at Indiana University East. And welcome to you, David.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And also with us on the phone is Wayne James, the Deputy Superintendent for Regional Law Enforcement and the first Chief Diversity Officer of the Indiana University Police Department. Wayne James, welcome.
Thank you.
Wayne, we'll start with you. We want to talk about your unique role within IUPD, but before we can talk about your position, as a Black man in a leadership role within law enforcement, can you share your perspective on the last 2 weeks?
Before I share my perspective, I want to thank, Black Lives Matter for being on this call, Jordan and Kim. Kim, I'm also from Gary, Indiana. I just recently relocated to the southern part of the state, central Indiana part of the state. My perspective over the last two weeks and just seeing this, I think with the George Floyd death, it was a tipping point of this systematic racism and events that have unfolded across the United States and actually serve as a reminder that we need to continue to try to change the best way we know how, being a Black man, but to witness that and witness some of these events that have occurred, you know, before the George Floyd, like Laquan McDonald, Tamir Rice, and many others, Breonna Taylor, is very disheartening to really read and watch. And I think it's a lot of work that still needs to be done surrounding around police and police practices and building better and effective relationships in our communities of Black and brown individuals.
How did your childhood there in Gary influence your decision to become a cop?
Well, I'll be completely honest with you. That was not a first choice for me. I had a younger brother who was shot in the back at the age of 15 years old in 19th and Adams.
I'm so sorry.
And what happened was, and he's still living, but he's paralyzed from the waist down. And what happened was the first responding officer, as my little brother was going in and out, reached in his pocket and took all his money out. My mom at the time, she had six kids. We were from the Color Doors at the time, and that's on 21st Avenue on the east side of Gary. When we complained about that, it fell on deaf ears. And it was a distrust there. You know, it was a distrust for a long time because as a kid, you didn't think that these things happened. You only see it on TV. But what came out of that is, you know, I had the opportunity to be mentored by some good officers as well and end up getting a few programs where, you know, I came to the conclusion where I wanted to be part of the conversation and sitting at the table and not on the menu. And I realized I couldn't affect that change just by sitting back idly by and not doing nothing. So the reason I became a police officer is to really, honestly, serve the community in the way they need to be served. And that's treated fair and respectable and how you would want to be treated, how they would want to be treated is why I really got into this job.
Did you get any pushback from family or community about your decision to go into law enforcement?
Yeah, it was pushback. And what I try to encourage is that, you know, we look at the numbers right now with minorities in law enforcement. And I hate using the word minorities because it sounds less than and it's not. Is that, you know, in the Black and brown communities, we don't get a lot of people that want to be police officers. And it sometimes it's frustrating because what we're trying to do is create not just change, but look towards the future. We don't want to look at it, and all our police departments are not diverse, and there's nothing but Caucasian males in this field as people. And I heard Jordan talk about earlier, you know, being able to police the community you live in, you just have that compassion and that care that, you know, if it's, you know, Bobby that's getting in trouble, you could go talk to Bobby. You know about the issues he may have as it relates to mental illness and things like that, so you can help him a little better than somebody really coming in saying, we're going to respond and their guns blazing. And when I say that is because back in 2016, I had the opportunity to meet Samaria Rice, the mother of Tamir Rice, in December of 2016, where we're still connected today about some of the issues in law enforcement, and she talked about her son, and it hit home because not in a million years I would think I would have to sit down with my 17-year-old daughter and have the talk with her. That wasn't common. But I recognize that. And I recognize we have an issue. And I believe the protest that has been going on, not just the last 2 weeks, but before this, brings change. But we have to continue the dialogue to what we really want to see that change.
What would you say, Wayne, is your philosophy of policing? What is the role of police in the community?
I think the role of police, how I envision it, you should be a guardian, a public servant, somebody that's approachable that the community want to talk to, not run away from. I have this distrust where I don't want to call this officer because, you know, I'm afraid if I call her, it's going to be more harm than foul. And I agree, we put ourselves sometimes in that situation. And it comes down to selection and hiring the right people. And I'm just glad that I work for an agency where we have over 200 officers statewide. I oversee most of them and over 327 employees, where we're able to affect that change and utilize our individuals at each of our IU campuses to come in and speak to our officers and train them on the different diversity issues and different cultures and cultural competencies and things like that. But I will tell you, diversity and inclusion should be more than just a saying. We should be demonstrating that on a daily basis, not just for IUPD, but in our police departments across the country. We have to start moving in the 21st century. And as a police chief, when I was at Northwest, I terminated a few officers. I turned the officer in one time for excessive force, and it didn't go over well. But it was the right thing to do, and I would do it again if I had to today.
David Kim is with us. He's a lecturer on criminal justice at IU East. David, for the relationship between the community and the police to be successful, we know that trust is critical. And you've looked into the research about what contributes to trust between communities and police. What's at play here?
Yes, hi. So there's a variety of factors that determine or impact the relationship between the citizen and the police. There's factors such as procedural justice, which I wanted to talk about today. It's concerned with the fairness and equity of the procedures, the interactions between the citizen and the police during traffic citations or street citations, how that plays out. So if citizens if the decisions are fair and neutral during the interactions, citizens are more likely to view police as legitimate and trustworthy. And another factor that's often compared with procedural justice is distributive justice, which is looks at the outcome of or the results from that interaction. But research has stated that citizens are more impacted by the procedures and decision-making process by the officers rather than the result or outcome. And so this is a big factor in determining the level of trust. There are other factors such as number of contacts, positive contacts, satisfaction, residential stability. It's not an exhaustive list, but there are a lot of factors that play a part in impacting the community policing relations.
We are talking about police reform today in the wake of nationwide protests and protests that are occurring here in Indiana. And we've just been talking with David Kim, a lecturer on criminal justice at Indiana University, as well as Wayne James, the deputy superintendent for regional law enforcement and the first chief diversity officer of the Indiana University Police Department. We're also joined by two representatives from Black Lives Matter. From Gary, Indiana, is Kim Gee, and from South Bend is Jordan Geiger. And Jordan, I have a question for you. Can you talk about what defunding the police means? What is the difference between a call to defund the police and a call to abolish the police?
Kind of putting me on the spot now.
I think the distinction needs to be made there.
So defunding can look like many things. So there's no like one size fits all, right? Because mm-hmm. what defunding may look like in your community might look different in mine. So I would speak for South Bend. So first, when we talk about defunding the police, that means the money that was set aside in like last year's budget to hire more officers, because they like to have their force at about 250 officers. Presently, they're at, I think, roughly 223. And they've budgeted money to hire about 20 more officers to get it up to about 245, or up to 240, actually, 240. So what we're saying is, instead of hiring more police officers, let's take that money away from the police department, and let's put that towards hiring community interventionists, people in the community who have real relationships with folks and who can de-escalate situations without the police getting involved. So that's what defunding, that's an example of what defunding kind of looks like here in South Bend. Now, in terms of abolishing the police, I mean, I don't think Black Lives Matter has a full position laid out on that. But I mean, it's recognizing that policing is based in slave catching, and that the institution of police departments will never serve the best interests of Black folks. And so as a result, we feel that, you know, they should be abolished as a whole.
I think the natural next question that a lot of people have when we talk about things like defunding the police is, who would be called instead? Who would be responding to the various calls for assistance that the police respond to now?
Community members would be. And that can happen. I mean, I've been in situations where I've de-escalated situations. Last year we had Black Voters Matter came to South Bend, and we held an event at a housing project, and it was a beautiful event. But after the event, a fight broke out between two women, and some other folks came in to engage in the in the fighting. And what we did was, a number of us just really walked right out in the middle of it and de-escalated the entire situation. And when the police showed up, By the time the police showed up, we pretty much had everything calmed down. But because they were demanding that the woman who was accused of being the offender, they demanded that she come and speak with them, it made the situation more tense. And then when we tried to explain to the officer, hey, you know, she needs to calm down right now. Like, we've got our city councilwoman who's with our organization. She's talking to her, you know, just right now, she doesn't want to talk to anybody. You know, just can we just let her sort of simmer down? And the police officer started yelling at her. No, she needs to come here right now. I need to know what happened. I need to talk to her. Those are the kind of interactions that make the situation worse. It doesn't help it.
Kim, what are your thoughts on divesting resources away from police? If that money were to be reinvested elsewhere in the community, where would you want to see it go?
Oh, of course, there's really endless actual services to community members that money could go to. So, or even education, because, you know, so much of community disenfranchisement, you know, is financial when we talk about communities being under-resourced, et cetera. So I just think the list is endless. I think it's really clear that, you know, there's always discussion of social services and where really so many other locations that money could go besides policing. I think what Jordan was talking about also in terms of how folks de-escalate situations in their communities already, like with the example he just gave, I actually think that's just so important to look at in terms of when we talk about how often police, and in certain circumstances and in certain situations and communities, they do seem to be able to de-escalate situations. But in a lot, you know, in Black communities, they seem to handle things much more aggressively and tend to not de-escalate. And how really community folks often work so much better with each other. Oftentimes, police do really both their tactics and even just the level of power they have, they tend to, you know, increase the fear and antagonism in a situation. So,
Wayne, as we mentioned before, you are the chief diversity officer at IUPD. Can you tell us about this position? Why was it created?
Actually, this position was created because of our need to really re-engineer a lot of our training and our diversity and outreach efforts across the state of Indiana. We serve 7 campuses and a few satellites across the state. Most of them, we have one in South Bay and also Indianapolis, Bloomington, in the city of Gary. And it was created to really look at our training and how we do things and de-escalate things. And one of the things that we did in 2017, we created the De-Escalation Commission for IUPD. And that commission included faculty, staff, and students and community members. And what we were tasked with was to review our current general order response to resistance, CFMU's best practices, look at our current training programs to ensure best practices are utilized, teaching and instructing de-escalation techniques for annual in-service training. We also looked at our academy curriculum and also our operational teams of what an officer had on his belt. From reviewing that, we were able to work with our community partners and our faculty to come out with some great recommendations that all have been implemented. And we have implemented where officers go through training and parts of policing, but also procedural justice. We recognize the need for mental health because we were running into several individuals who suffer from mental health, not just students, but also community members and some of the cities that we serve. So we wanted our officers to be more closely responsive and aware when they respond to those calls to have, you know, a little more experience to be able to de-escalate those situations. One of the other things we did, we purchased a virtual simulator, and we got away from the traditional shoot, don't shoot training. And what this system does is it pretty much focused on de-escalation, scenario-based training, which could be a form of verbal de-escalation to also have to pull out his taser or spray and things like that, but to de-escalate situations more effectively. Also, we have a use of force tracking form with a workflow, so we are able to identify early warning signs if a person is excessive, so we get complaints. Also, we have a checkbox on there if they de-escalate a situation. But anytime an officer even pull out his weapon, they have to fill out that form and it's reviewed. One of our first things we do is require de-escalation technique first when feasible prior to any use of force pursuant to Indiana law, which requires officers to provide warning when feasible to a person prior to using deadly force. I can tell you in our general order that chokeholds and restrictions of breathing are considered deadly force, and routine chokeholds and strangleholds are prohibited. We don't hog tie. Our policy requires officers to sit suspects upright when on the ground. Then they have a duty to intervene. So if it's an officer that's using excessive force against anyone that they're arresting, the other officers on scene have to report that to a supervisor who then have to report it to a chief. And if they don't do that, they're going to be terminated with the officer in deemed that this officer used too much excessive force. We have completed a complete overhaul, and this all occurred back in 2017, which we use annually.
We'll pick this up at the end of the or at the beginning of the next segment. We'll be live with our guests after a quick break to continue this conversation. You can send us your questions and comments on police reform. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In.
Yes, they receive procedural justice training as well as fair and impartial policing training to really check that. And I want to go back to the use of force before
sure.
I'm going. You know, we have a flow where all officers, the way we do things is, you know, you collect information. You assess the situation, threats and risk. We consider our police powers and our agency policies. That's what a lot of this is driven from. And then we start identifying our options, best course of action, and act and review and reassess before a decision is made. Our first, like before any force, is always de-escalation. And that's what we try our best to do and whatnot and lead. But in fair and impartial policing, we try to look at, you know, those consequences, those hidden biases, the impacts of perception and behavior. And we try to teach that to police professionals. We do teach that to all officers, police professionals. And, you know, we put this on annually, and we try to create dialogue with our officers to get them to see, you know, from the other side, the other perspectives, and, you know, welcoming those perspectives and understanding that we may not always disagree, but we need to open our minds up to new ideas that don't take away from who we are. But if we're able to discuss those, if we don't discuss those differences, things will never change. And we try to, you know, drive that home to them as far as that. But when you look at procedural justice, you know, as it refers to fairness and processes that resolve disputes and allocate resources, you're looking at fairness as the process, transparency in our action, and opportunity for voice, and make sure the impartiality in decision-making. And a lot of this is implemented in our training where every IUPD officer has been through this training, and we have follow-up to these conversations as well as we train this in our Indiana University Police Academy, which we're one of six academies that's been approved by the Law Enforcement Training Board in the state of Indiana.
David Kim, on the subject of bias training, is there evidence that it works?
There's evidence that it increases awareness by police officers regarding implicit bias and bias policing. However, the results are inconclusive on whether it helps diminish crimes in neighborhoods. But there are different factors that plays a part in this. Implicit bias may be a factor in where fatigue and day-to-day encounters may factor in implicit bias. And so there's different ways of testing implicit bias, but still in research, it's still inconclusive.
Kim, your chapter of Black Lives Matter in Gary was founded after the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. Police reform was a big topic back then as well as it was in many communities, even before that, of course. But we're still talking about it today. When we talk about trust between communities and the police, is it hard to trust that meaningful reform is going to take place?
Definitely, because the past is your best indication, you know, of what's going to happen in the future, unfortunately, in a lot of situations. So I think there's there's always a lot of talk about training. And, like, even in Gary, I know that there was, like, with the last administration, you know, there was some increased training. There was a project with the Department of Justice, you know, and all that goes on while at the same time, you know, you still continue to have these killings. And the same process pretty much still plays out where the issue, you know, the officer, you know, they don't name or identify the officer. They go on paid leave, if that, and Lake County so-called investigates, and then the prosecutor just clears the case or doesn't even announce his decision at all indefinitely. So many things seem to remain the same when we talk about change. It kind of starts to look like a lot of lip service. So if the actual policies, you know, aren't changing.
Jordan, I want to hear from you on this, too. What do you think the path to restoring trust with your community and the police, between the community and the police, has to look like?
I think right now has looked like removing the police officers from our communities. That's why we are pushing for the IDI, the intercultural development inventory, because if we can understand the mindset of the officers, then we know who we need to remove from our communities. We know who is not able to deal with folks who belong to different cultures and who have different life experiences. So that's what I feel right now. The city of South Bend, after the unrest around Eric Logan's murder, they called for a number of what they call community action group meetings. And we sat down and we went over policies, procedures, training. We also looked at, when we talked about the training, we specifically learned about how they were implementing diversity training. And what we found was that it was really inconsistent. Even the trainers didn't really even know about the training. They didn't really take it all that seriously. You had some officers who had a certain kind of training, but then the other officers who were new to the force had a different kind of training. So it just wasn't consistent across the board. So it almost made you feel like, okay, you know, this is a great headline to say that, you know, you're now implementing this new training, but in actuality, there's no real commitment to it. And so that's why we're saying, you know, we can't trust them to make these officers better. I mean, they, you know, that kind of bias training goes against the training that they have when they are trained to come in, to go into the field. So we've got to do something different. You know, we've got to have real oversight over the police. We've got to defund the police and hire interventionists. We've got to have a real community driven public safety plan and not one that's driven by a police department that has a history of misconduct and abuse against Black folks.
Wayne James, one of the requests that both citizens in Gary and South Bend have asked for explicitly is one that we've talked about already, a civilian review board, which gets to this idea of accountability. Can you talk about what systems of accountability are in place within your department?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on in South Bend, but Gary, I know they have a civil service commission that's all civilians that's responsible for discipline and hiring and firing and whatnot. And I like all the points that Jordan said and also Kim, and I think it's very important. But I just want to reiterate, there are some departments out here that trying to affect that change, and I could just speak on my agency not knowing the history of those two agencies intimately, and I apologize for that. But I think, you know, if you look at civilian oversight, it has to be right and it has to be fair and objective. And I guess, you know, I can't really comment on that, not knowing what that would look like at these agencies, because it looks different at my agency. So if you look at some of the shootings that have occurred, even with like Laquan McDonald and the Cleveland Tamir Rice incident and several others, you have real strong unions that really stop a lot of the process. And I guess that's what takes so long with some of them investigations. What I can tell you, is with IU PD is that, you know, our authority comes from the Board of Trustees and my boss and his boss and whatnot. So we don't have to go through a lot of the different things that some agencies have to go through. Of course, we have to make sure that our employees are getting due process, but we don't have to go to different boards to terminate them. And we have terminated officers who have not been on board, not to talk about personnel issues, but we have been able to get rid of those officers quickly. fact, going through the process we have and not have to wait for union and, you know, first step, second step, and different things like that. So that has really helped us, and that's all I can comment on with that, that working for a university, you are bound by a much higher standard because we have that board of trustees system, and then it's bound by the president's office, and our authority comes from the board of trustees as well.
We're talking about police reform today on All In, and we have a panel of guests. Jordan Geiger is an organizer within the Black Lives Matter chapter of South Bend. Kim McGee is an organizer with Black Lives Matter in Gary, Indiana. Wayne James, who we've just spoke with, is deputy superintendent for regional law enforcement and the first chief diversity officer of the Indiana University Police Department. We'll now go to David Kim, who is a lecturer on criminal justice at Indiana University East. And David, Wayne just mentioned police unions, and the strength of police unions are often cited as this obstacle to full accountability. How much power do these unions typically have?
They have an immense amount of power. They have the power to change policy. They have powers to change the procedures. And so in order to have everything working out perfectly or effectively and efficiently, the public and the police union have to work together. There can't be any conflict. There has to be a collaboration between those two. Police union have been useful for police officers, and also has been useful for community members as well in research. And so there just needs to be more collaboration between the two rather than conflict.
There's another obstacle that's often cited, legal doctrine like qualified immunity. I guess for those who are unfamiliar with the term, can you explain what qualified immunity is?
Yes. So a qualified immunity is a shield for public officials, such as police officers, from being sued for actions that they take while acting in their official capacity. And so actions that don't violate a clearly established statutory or constitutional right are type of qualified immunities. But the key word here is clearly established. So it has to have a precedent. There needs to be a prior case regarding that their conduct was illegal. And it has to be clearly established in the prior court ruling that bars that such conduct. If a police officer commits a violent conduct, and it's looked at whether they would be granted qualified immunity or not, there's a couple of questions that are asked. First of all, is did police use excessive force? If they did, should they have known that the conduct was illegal because it violated a clearly established prior court ruling? If there was no violation of a clearly established prior court ruling, then they'll be granted qualified immunity.
Jordan Geiger, let's go back to police unions. We know that unions themselves are designed to protect their workers, but police unions are particularly strong. Have police unions had an impact on the efforts in South Bend to enact the kind of change you want to see?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The police union is incredibly resistant to change. 4 years ago, we organized around the case of Deshaun Franklin, who in 2012 was beaten in his sleep at 17 years old by Aaron Knepper in a case of mistaken identity. And a federal judge in 2016, 4 years later, ruled that him and his family's constitutional and civil rights were violated, but awarded them a grand total of $18. So we started organizing heavily, calling for the removal of Aaron Knepper and for police reform. At that time, the city was in the process of renegotiating its contract with the union, but the union was incredibly resistant to change. Currently, as of yesterday, we were successful in stopping the city council from approving a spending bill that would increase the pay of police officers. Union FOP President Harvey has been arguing, and the chief of police, who's a past president of the union, they both have been arguing that if officers do not feel more appreciated, because right now they feel attacked given all the national attention on South Bend, and if they do not receive an increase in their pay, then they will leave I'm really tired from all this protesting.
I can understand.
A lot of people will leave the force. They will quit, or they will retire, because a third of our police force is actually eligible for retirement. They have 20 years in. Now, what the mayor has done is he's sort of negotiated this kind of agreement between the union and the city. And part of that agreement was that if they were to receive an increase in pay, then they would concede. Give us some concessions around new training, around the establishment of a police complaint board. They would support those things, because those have to be also worked out within the union agreement.
Kim,
so I don't know what's happening.
Go ahead.
I don't know what's going to happen now that they have postponed or delayed the vote on the pay raises. The FOP president was quoted in the South Bend Tribune saying that this will have a big impact on the morale of the police officers here, and that many of them will likely leave, which we welcome. We encourage them to leave the force and to retire early.
Kim, I want to talk about decentralized police departments in our last few minutes. The upside to decentralized police departments is that there's room for communities to influence how policing is handled in their communities. And we're seeing that play out in a lot of big cities that are making commitments to change the status quo of policing right now, one of the goals. But that requires leaders in elected positions to make those changes. What kinds of conversations are happening in your community around the importance of voting to enact that local change?
Well, voting, there's always, you know, a lot of discussion about voting in general. I don't see where really any politician was really wanted to champion that particular issue in terms of police accountability. So I think so much of it is really about groups and individuals pressuring the politicians, because it's not as if any of them, even in office, were terribly forthcoming. So at the beginning of Prince's administration in January, you know, we brought up the issue that of the Civilian Review Board. And he was like, well, you know, I just got here. I got to take a look at things and yada, yada, yada. And there was no more said about that. Now, of course, and even at that time, actually, the family of Rashad Cunningham had actually interrupted his inauguration.
Kim, just about 10 seconds left, I'm afraid.
So we really haven't seen anything from the politicians on that.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests today for a great conversation and taking the time. We really appreciate it. Jordan Geiger is an organizer for Black Lives Matter in South Bend. Jordan, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kim McGee is an organizer with Black Lives Matter in Gary. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
David Kim is a lecturer on criminal justice at IU East. Thank you, David.
Thank you for having me on.
Wayne James is Deputy Superintendent for Regional Law Enforcement at the IU Police Department. Thank you, Wayne James. And I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.